This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, North Carolina prisons house more than 37,000 inmates. For many of those, the road to incarceration started on the school grounds. Students face zero-tolerance policies and increased police presence in schools. Infractions lead to suspensions and expulsions, and disadvantaged and minority students are especially vulnerable. The organization Hidden Voices talked with many of the players in the pipeline, students, teachers, attorneys, and police, and then turned those interviews into art. The project, called None of the Above, takes several forms, including an art exhibit at the UNC Student Union and a dramatic performance tonight and tomorrow night at the UNC Stone Center. Lyndon Harris is the founder and director of Hidden Voices and with us now. Lyndon, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Also with us, Brandy Bullock, a former teacher in the Durham and Wake County public school system and a recent law school graduate. She performs in None of the Above. Brandy, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Joshua Byrd managed to escape the school-to-prison pipeline. He became first a Marine, then a law enforcement officer, and most recently a law school graduate. He performs in None of the Above and is with us now. Joshua, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us is John Powell, who we will talk to a little bit later in the program to talk about some of the ways out of this, possibly. But Joshua, let me begin with you. You escaped this largely, but only barely, and members of your family found themselves part of it. Tell us about your background.
Right. Well, I wouldn't give myself the credit. I did not escape it. There were some influences. I did grow up in a single family, single parent home, and I had four sisters, three older sisters, who did not graduate from high school. I think that it was the extracurricular activities, the time that my mom had once she remarried, to allow me to engage in other activities at school, sports. ROTC was a really a major influence, and those things really helped me. I was suspended, like my sisters, for trivial things, but it was the extracurricular activities. ROTC really built me up, a lot of encouragement, support, things that my sisters never had, and I also was not necessarily involved in some of the bad things that they were involved in as I was doing a lot of other positive
Well, tell
things.
Us about your sisters and what happened to them, how things ended up for them.
Well, my mother and father neither finished high school straight out. My mom later went back to school, but my father stopped his education in the third grade. And from my perspective, I believe that there was really never a reason, if you will, to finish high school. No one pushed you and said, you will graduate, you will finish. And you look around in the community, and none of the other kids were graduating either. Many of them had family members, sisters, brothers, mothers, aunts, cousins who were incarcerated. And so the norm, if you will, was that someone may graduate, and when they graduate high school, it's a big deal, and let's applaud them. But if you don't, it's not a big deal either. You will fit in with the general population of the community.
What's that got to do with suspensions and what's happening in school? That sounds like individuals who say to themselves, they look around and maybe for good reason say there's no point in it. That doesn't sound like the school's fault. That doesn't sound like suspensions have anything to do with that.
Well, suspensions have a big thing to do with it. They play a role because when you're home and you're around individuals who didn't graduate, they're there to reinforce what's going on in the community. Oh, it's okay. You know, I didn't finish school either. You can come work with us. You could sell drugs. You can just hang out. You don't need to do all of that. You know, school wasn't for me. It's not for everyone. And that school isn't for everyone thing is really pervasive in my community, the one I grew up in, and many other communities around the nation. And it's not for everyone. But high school, I believe, is for everyone. And in fact, it's the law around the land that students stay in high school at least at the age of 16. And so But that was one of the things. When you're home and you're suspended, you tend to start to listen to those who are around you. And if they didn't finish high school, which they likely didn't, you're going to do what they do, and you're going to do what students who are suspended do.
Brandy, you taught in Wake and Durham County schools. What part do you think suspensions play in all of this? Do they? Because we're talking now about a clear link between the criminal justice system and suspensions early on in the school system, and then in particular whether or not minority and disadvantaged students are particularly harmed by this system. As a teacher, did you see this in play?
Oh, of course. I saw it both in middle school and in high school. And I think both suspensions, short-term suspensions, as well as long-term suspensions, both feed into the school-to-prison pipeline. When students are suspended from school, they lose instructional time, and that's time that they should be in class learning, whether they are in school suspension, where they don't have a teacher in front of them teaching them, or whether, as Joshua said, they are at home with other influences. Both of those definitely influence students to do things other than learn.
And it, from what Joshua was saying, is if you're living in a place where people aren't placing much attention or putting much attention on education, or where nothing in your surroundings supports the idea that you should get an education, even if your parents are telling you you better study and better shape up, suspending you from school doesn't sound like it's going to wake you up. I mean, in a sense, it doesn't sound like the right solution, and it doesn't sound like you're culturally sensitive that you understand what's going on in your school if you think that's going to change that student.
No, suspensions definitely don't help. And, you know, that's why we have school, and we have teachers, and we have administrators, and we have guidance counselors to guide students in the right direction. So when you tell students, okay, we want you to learn, and we want you to become a productive citizen, and then if they make a mistake, you tell them, okay, well, we'll just send you home. What type of message does that send to the student? That's not teaching them. That's not helping them to learn anything. That's just telling them you don't want them to be in school and you don't want them to learn. So that's a negative message that schools are sending to students.
You've been on suspension panels, those tribunals in which the decision is made. Tell us about how they work.
Well, the way that they work, if a student is long-term suspended, which means they're suspended for 10 days with the potential to be suspended for the rest of the year, then a parent has the ability to request a long-term suspension hearing. And so usually there's the administrator or a school resource officer, if that person was the person that that wanted them to be long-term suspended, the principal. And then on the other side, there's also a panel of teachers. And that panel of teachers is making the decision as to whether that student is long-term suspended or not. Ultimately, it's the principal's decision, but the teachers make the initial decision. You know, and the problem with that is that the teachers believe that, you know, they have to side with the principal because their job is at stake if they don't. And then you have the parent and the student on the other side, and all they have, as my character says, is the school handbook. And they don't really understand suspension policies. They don't understand school policies. And so they don't understand how the system works. And so if that's all you have, then that child has the potential to be long-term suspended. Then they're out of school for a year. And then there's more of the opportunity to drop out of school later on because then they're behind.
And, of course, this whole discussion really centers on questions of school safety. These zero tolerance policies emerge out of a sense that schools aren't safe, so we have to do something. So here we go. I wonder, in those suspension hearings, how much of the discussion is on what impact this will have on that student and how much of that is on how we have to keep our school safe?
Well, there's generally no discussion on how it impacts the student, and that's based on the suspension hearings that I've been on. You know, I've seen teachers talk about how students have been suspended for, you know, dress code violations, or they've been suspended for, you know, giving a student an Advil or a Tylenol or something like that, suspended for the rest of the year for trivial issues. And so instead of dealing with the problem or dealing with the issue, then you're just taking kids out of school.
And you can also be suspended for truancy.
Exactly, for not coming to school.
That'll teach me. Lyndon Harris, how did you hear about this, and what made you decide to make this one of the subject of your latest Hidden Voices?
Well, in 2010, the Advancement Project out of Washington, D.C., came to Durham, and they wanted Durham to be sort of their Southeast regional hub to start a national grassroots movement to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. So some colleagues called us and said, do you want to participate? So we went to the meeting with the Advancement Project. And what's really remarkable is that in those 3 years, they've actually succeeded in creating a national conversation around something that most people had never, ever heard of before. So it, you know, the subject deals with race, with poverty, with educational policies, with incarceration, and they were all topics that we dealt with over the years. So the idea of doing a project that brought them all together was pretty exciting.
How did you design the project, this particular production, and also the exhibits that go with it?
Well, it was a pretty overwhelming amount of material. We worked in 20 counties around North Carolina, talking with all the different stakeholders that we could find. And we ended up with about, once the interviews were transcribed, we had about 1,300 pages of material. And then, yeah, we were left kind of looking at it going, oh, well.
How is that a show?
Yeah. Yeah. How are we going to do this? So, and also, because the people that we work with are not performers, they're participants that we've interviewed and talked to, trying to figure out, we knew they wouldn't be able to get together to rehearse. So trying to come up with an idea for what we could create that they could all to come together once and then be able to perform was pretty remarkable. So I hit on the idea of doing a live radio broadcast, remarkably like the state of things at Triad Stage. I thought, oh, we could do this. And it's been really fun, too, because the audience has come up to her several times in the radio host is Ernest Justice, and they've been asking, what station is he on? I want to tune into this guy. So people have been really excited, you know, with the idea that this is a radio show.
And allows people to talk about the issue. We'll find out how that plays out as we continue our conversation with Lyndon Harris, the director of the Hidden Voices Project, and others. Brandy Bullock is with us, Joshua Byrd, to talk about None of the Above on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline and a project called None of the Above. It explores the pipeline through art. The project, Hidden Voices, an organization that is headed by Lyndon Harris, the founder and director. She's with us along with Brandy Bullock, a former teacher in Durham and Wake County Public Schools, a recent law school graduate and a performer in the program. Joshua Byrd is a former law enforcement officer, a Marine, and a recent law school graduate. He also performs in None of the Above. And joining us now is John Powell, an attorney and director of the Juvenile Justice Project at Campbell University School of Law. He uses restorative justice to try to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, and he's also a performer in the play. John, welcome. Good to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Tell us about restorative justice and what part that might play in ending or at least disrupting, as I said, the school-to-prison pipeline.
Well, restorative justice, first of all, is a non-punitive theory of justice, and what it does is it tries to understand how people have been injured through either crime or bad behavior. And it focuses on who's been hurt, how have they been hurt, and now what ought to be done by these participants to try to make things right.
And it's interesting because we get back to this safety question. If we say, well, if we don't suspend these students, what are we going to do? How does restorative justice work, and can it contribute at all to school safety?
It's very interesting to me in the work that we do in schools. We still see kids that are suspended, and so we try to meet them on the first day that they come back so we can help resolve the conflict. What we realize is that while they were out on suspension, they were on the social media. And not only did they expand the conflict, but they invited many dozens of other students to join the conflict. So by the time they come back to school, the conflict has not gotten better. It actually has grown. So what we do is we sit down with them, first of all, individually, to give them an opportunity to understand, first of all, we're not here to hurt you. We're here to try to help you. We're a neutral party. We don't work for the schools. We don't work for the court system. And we give them a chance to talk about what has happened and as much of the why as they understand. Of course, no one person understands all the why. That's why we bring in all the parties that have been a part of the conflict to help them to understand with each other the why. And then we work to bring those parties together so they can have that conversation. It's very important once they understand the why, because that's when the conflict and the ill will begins to fall away from that.
What's the role of the offender in this case in terms of their coming to terms with precisely what it is they did? Is there any, I mean, how does this, do we all just sit around in a circle and say, oh, I understand, you have a troubled background, John. No problem starting that fire in the trash can. Now let's all go back to school. I mean, how does this work?
We don't do that. One of the things that the criminal justice system says that it does, and one of its purposes is to hold people accountable for their actions. There's a huge difference in holding someone accountable and giving someone else the opportunity to acknowledge their wrongdoing and hold themselves accountable. So we create a safe place that they can admit wrongdoing without fear that it's going to come back to hurt them in a punitive way, because we don't talk to the authorities about what they tell us. Now, there are exceptions, and if we believe that they may be on the way to hurt someone, we have an obligation to report those things, which we do. We rarely need to do that. But we give them a safe place to admit the wrongdoing, to talk about and to understand how they've hurt others. And once they know that they can do that, they're well on their way to taking responsibility for what they've done. And then it's remarkable how their future behavior changes in very positive ways.
Have you really seen that? Is there's actual evidence of that?
Absolutely. The first 8 years of the program, we were grant-funded, so we had an obligation to keep the data on all of that. And so we do keep up with recidivism rates and resuspension rates. And what we know is that recidivism and suspension rates hover around 15% reoffense, which is, if you know anything about recidivism, that is a very good number. The other thing that we know is that for similarly situated kids that are sent to the program that for whatever reason do not have the face-to-face meeting, they tend to reoffend and resuspend at about three times the rate that the ones that do have the face-to-face meeting.
And you know, Brandy, it's interesting you talk about getting back to those conferences that you sit in, whereas you said they don't talk at all about the student. It's only about keeping the school safe. They tend to repeat now under that system three times more often. And again, that student who is suspended, never accountable, so off they go, and nobody knows if a change has happened in that student. In fact, it's very unlikely, isn't it?
And that's true. You know, as school systems and as a state, we really need to look at the policies and the statutes that we have in place so that we can work to help students and to help kids and to make sure that they stay in school and that they're learning. Because what happens is these kids grow up to become adults, and when they become adults, then, you know, they offend. And so we need to make sure that they're learning and they're doing the right things whenever they're in school and when they're younger.
Joshua, you were a law enforcement officer yourself, so I'm guessing you've come in contact with some of the kids that we're talking about. Tell us about your experience as a law enforcement officer.
Absolutely. And before I jump into that, I can say to follow up on what Brandy said, they become adults. I had many peers who are serving in prison now or recently got out of prison where they were suspended, managed to graduate, but in the process, the crowds they hung around on those days off and picked up friends along that process tend to push them towards a certain path in life. But in law enforcement, you find many times that these students have not, or these young men and women have not graduated from high school. They're illiterate. They don't feel capable. They don't feel like education is for them because somewhere along the line, the system didn't work for them. Whether they were suspended, they were classified as a certain type of child, labeled, and took on that label, and they still walk around with that label, and you see it all the time in prison and in jails.
Yeah, that's the idea of internalizing the message that you're better off outside of this system. You say that enough, I'm going to start to believe you, right? Mm-hmm. So, Lyndon, what are the statistics in terms of, just give us a rough idea of the disproportionate way in which minorities, people who are disadvantaged, and also people with disabilities, right, are disadvantaged by this system?
Well, some of the numbers that we looked at that were pretty astonishing to us were for first-time cell phone use in schools. And I think a lot of us are really surprised to find out you can even get suspended for a first-time cell phone use. That was rather remarkable. And in some of the counties in North Carolina, for instance, 4.8% of the white students were suspended for first-time cell phone use, and 32.6% of the African-American students were suspended for exactly the same infraction. You see the same kinds of disparities in public displays of affection. In dress code offenses, you can get suspended for first-time dress code offense. And again, it's close to nine times the number of African-American students who are suspended as to the white students. And so we know that suspensions and court referrals lead kids to drop out. Just one court appearance for a student, it makes them four times more likely to drop out of school, and a high school dropout is nine times as likely to end up in prison. So it's very clear the pipeline effect.
John, I know that that you have not been at this in the schools perhaps long enough to know, but is there any way to tell what happens to students who come through a restorative justice process and the likelihood that they're going to be come in contact with criminal justice system compared to those who were suspended?
I think there are ways to measure that. We have not measured those, Frank. One thing that we have measured is the resuspension rates of these same kids within the school system. We have not measured the effect on school mediation work and whether it keeps them out of the court system or not. I think, though, that there is an obvious effect. that if you can keep kids from getting trouble in school that's having them suspended, they're much less likely to be arrested and sent into our criminal justice system.
So that's pretty good proof that something has happened. What do you see in the actual process when the student, you say, takes responsibility? What does that look like? What does that sound like? Do I just have to say, yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, and then I go back to school and cheap grace?
Well, that's not good enough for me as a facilitator. And I have shut down processes before when I recognized that kids were trying to use the process simply as a way to navigate around another kind of system. Our program exists for kids who want to come in and acknowledge wrongdoing and take responsibility and do something more positive. Now, almost none of them want to do that when they first sit down and start talking with us. But once they realize they're in a safe place, they do want to do that because, quite frankly, they do not want to be in conflict. They do not want to be in trouble. They do not want to get suspended. They want to have a good, positive life, and they do want to learn in the school system that they're in. So when we can create that safe place for them to come into, very quickly you begin to see the defense mechanisms fall away and they begin to take responsibility and act in much more positive ways.
Joshua, that gets to something you were saying earlier about internalizing this message that we don't want you here. Here we're looking at this threshold moment, this moment in the student's career where you can change that and turn people around, I guess, that it isn't built in from the moment they walked into that school. Something happened in that school and there's a choice. You can go either way as a school system, depending on the choice you make.
Absolutely. And oftentimes we find that the choice is easily to say, I'm going to take the route towards accepting this label because it's cool. It's you're accepted. You look at the stereotypes in the media. School isn't the most popular thing to do. Rap, hip hop, these sort of things are what many minority males aspire to in addition to sports. And so when you start to take on labels that you're the bad guy, you're the tough guy, that almost becomes sort of a pride. And now you're in a dilemma. Do I go this way and be popular and be respected in school, or do I take the route to where I'm really going to fight for my right to an education when you don't have the tools to really do that? You don't really have anyone pushing you to do that. And it's almost kind of nerdy to do that.
Yeah.
And so many kids end up saying, I'm going to accept the label and go here where I'm wanted. And there's a line in the play where they say, you know, students, when they're suspended, can go somewhere where they're wanted and accepted. And that's home or in the streets.
Yeah. So imagine a process devised by the school that opens a door to that other path. Restorative justice is one of them. John, you have some a part in this play. You play, I believe, John Powell.
I do. But that's an easy thing for me to do.
Can you give us some of that role right now?
Yeah, one of the lines that I have is something that came out of my frustration as a criminal defense attorney years ago when I was working within the juvenile system. And I say it's very easy for kids to get into the system and very hard for them to get out. I would often say to the prosecutor, you know, we ought to be able to sit down and talk about this. I didn't know about restorative justice at that point in time, but I did know if you can't communicate, you can't solve problems. So that's the mediator within me. And I had that within me even as a criminal defense attorney. And I would often say to the prosecutor, can't we sit down and talk about this? And to give her credit, she would almost always say, yes, if you can get the prosecuting witness to talk to you, yes, have at it. They almost never would because I was the enemy, right? I was a defense attorney. Most of them were not about to talk to me.
So there are alternatives and ways to work this. But, Brandy, you are a teacher. You've been part of the system. It seems to me that schools have taken the path of least resistance. Look, let's just get them out of the school. That's the easy thing to do. Is this a hard sell? Would this be a hard sell in schools to say we have this other process, it's restorative justice, let's try it? Is there a lot of resistance in schools?
No. In fact, I think John is in several schools in Wake County. In fact, he's in one of my old schools in Wake County as well, which I'm very happy to see. So it's not a hard sell. However, I think As a state and as a nation, I think that we are running towards safety whenever, for example, we're running towards police officers in schools. And as a state, especially in North Carolina, our children are particularly vulnerable because we have laws where all 16 and 17-year-olds mandatorily go into the adult criminal system. They don't go into the juvenile criminal system. And so if they're charged by a school resource officer in school for anything, then they mandatorily go into the adult criminal system. And even if they're below the age of 16, they still go into the juvenile system, but they still may have problems in the juvenile court system. So as a state, as schools, we need to take responsibility for our kids because our kids are just kids. And we need to make sure that we're treating them as such and stop making our schools into prisons and make them schools again.
And schools are institutions and they are going to look at what resources they have available. And so if a problem occurs and all you have is a police officer, it goes to the police officer. If you
right.
had a police officer and restorative justice, you could make a choice.
Right.
But one of the parts of the play, Brandy and Joshua, and I want you to give us part of your roles in this play, indicates that the schools are, as institutions, always looking out for their best interest, which aren't always what happens to the student. Maybe you can set up this next piece for us.
Brandy, I'll let you talk about how tests are critical part of the education system now and how high-stakes testing affects the school-to-prison pipeline that we can go into our lines.
Well, with No Child Left Behind, that definitely set up a system where schools were always looking at test scores. And so a lot of times principals would suspend students and definitely long-term suspend students because those students had learning disabilities or they found that those students' test scores would be too low. And so that's what Joshua and I talk about in the play.
And so the lines are, my line leads and then Brandy follows and I come again, but it's, we had to take pretest before we were allowed to take benchmarks before we could take the end of course test. So the percentage of students that passed the end of course test that year was really high. Because all the other students had been weeded out. They had to come to class even though they already knew they'd have to repeat it.
It's very much about gaming the scores. You can't have students in there who are going to mess up your results. There's just too much riding on the numbers.
For me, it sort of worked in reverse because I got suspended for going off at a teacher. And then Monday morning, the office called saying that decided to unsuspend me. There just happened to be a computer skills test that day, and they wanted my scores. Just as soon as I finished the test, they resuspended me. And we go on in dialogue talking about how, just as Brandy said, they rely on you for your test scores, but if you have been suspended, you're gone. They may bring you back in for your results, but that's it. Meanwhile, other students who don't score as well remain suspended.
So, Lyndon, talk about the process of learning all of this, of gathering this kind of testimony and then working it into the play. I mean, how did you first hear this? And when you heard it, I mean, this is a calculation on the part of the school. This isn't just a, well, we didn't come up with the best possible discipline policy. I guess we'll rethink it. This is intentional. What were your reactions as you were gathering these interviews? Did any of that surprise you when you were pulling this together?
Everything surprised me. We heard story after story after story from children who were caught in the pipeline. I think that's the most difficult part. They were caught in the pipeline without understanding that that was what it was. You know, it was just, from their perspective, there was just overwhelming chaos happening in their life, and they didn't really understand that there was this structural problem that was going to continue to push them out of school just as it had pushed their family out of school and most of the friends that they saw. So we, you know, and we talked to teachers, and teachers said very, very similar things about their own frustrations with the testings, with the high-stakes testing, with not being allowed in a lot of the schools to handle discipline, that they had, you know, buttons to push to call the school resource officer. They were not allowed to deal with discipline anymore. You know, we listened, talked to a lot of attorneys who represented students, and over we heard attorneys saying, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've represented hundreds of kids. I could count on two hands how many have been white.
You've done one performance already last weekend. What was the response you got?
Wow. It was pretty invigorating, I think, because we've been living with this for some years. For us, it's not quite as shocking anymore. It was very shocking for the audience. A lot of people said it felt like a punch in the gut some of the time. They just were really, really stunned. But there was an overwhelming sense of, and this is what I hope people take away, is that we did create this. We can uncreate it. These are very specific policies. We can change them. It's been changed in other districts in the country, and we can do it here in North Carolina. And I think people felt very energized to actually take hold. And in the program, there's a 2 pages that say do one thing, and it tells you options that you can do. So I think people felt both people said they were horrified and energized.
Your performance tonight is where?
At the Stone Center.
What time?
8 p.m.
Tonight and tomorrow?
Yes. Friday and Saturday, and then October 5th at Duke.
And then there's going to be an exhibit as well. Tell us just a little bit about that and
okay.
Where it's going to be.
The exhibit right now is at the Student Union at UNC, and then it's going to the Jameson Gallery at Duke, and then it's going to travel around North Carolina. So we'll be taking the exhibit into communities along with a reading of monologues.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Lyndon Harris, founder and director of Hidden Voices, creator of None of the Above, co-collaborator, I would say. Brandi Bullock, a former teacher in Durham and Wake and County School Systems, a recent law school graduate and a performer. Joshua Byrd, former law enforcement officer, Marine, and recent law school graduate. He is also in None of the Above, as is John Powell, an attorney and director of the Juvenile Justice Project at Campbell University Law School. And to learn more about the project, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, live music on the State of Things. Stay tuned.